Welcome to Marketgy. Grab some coffee and let's talk about what's working in marketing, who these strategies are designed for, and how to be customer-centric while we do it.
Good morning. This is Leanne Dalweimer with Marketgy. Today, I've got an amazing guest, Trevor Van Worden. He is an online media veteran. He's been through things. Trevor, could you please tell us more about you and your background?
Okay, well, let's see. So currently, let's just kind of wind back, right? So currently I work for Infuse. I've been here for 6.5 years, give or take. So, you know, a little time in at one place. Prior to that, so my online media veteran. Prior to that was with a startup that was a website, right? Straight up content, sold to personal injury lawyers. Before that was with Dex Media, sold phone books and associated media there. Before that was with an outfit called Media Bistro. And Media Bistro did all kinds of, you know, web content and job listings and things of that nature. And before that was with Quinn Street, and before that internet.com and so on and so forth, right? So have been in online media, digital media since around 1997, give or take. So, you know, before a few listeners here probably were born, and that's okay, right? It's just, I've seen some stuff and have, one of my favorite stories to tell is how do you even get started in this thing? And it was when, 1997, AT&T comes out with cell phones, right? And you have a free nationwide calling plan. Okay. Or we got to pay for the plan, but just like, there's no like incremental long distance charges. Okay, great. I have a job and work for Merck, right? And at that time, I'm in the car all day long, driving up and down the freeway. And there's no rules, there's no laws against using your cell phone while you're driving. Okay, no big deal. I can just drive, you can just talk and drive, big deal. So my buddy starts up a website and he says, "Trevor, I need some help selling ads. Can you help me?" I was like, "Sure, why not? What the heck? You know, big deal." So I get my cell phone, we start making calls. And we start selling ads for this website called 15seconds.com, which was, at the time, was the amount of time somebody would wait for a web page to resolve. Okay. All right. If it's less than half a second or more than half a second now, like, you wouldn't even wait. So at that time, that was pretty normal and what we would do. And so that was the name of the website. It was a developer-facing website, and we sold ads to, I don't know, ISPs and Microsoft and job guys and all kinds of stuff. So that was the start. And he eventually sold that. And I went along with the acquirer, and, you know, the rest is history.
That's crazy. I mean, I just want to call out that at one point in time, you could get the domain internet.com. Someone could actually do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was insane. Alan Meckler, that was kind of one of his claims to fame. He owned that. And that domain was actually harder to build a business around than you would think. Like, what do you do with that thing? And as a media company, it worked pretty well. But by no means was it like massively differentiating. It stood out, you know, but at the same time, he got it and loved it and was really proud of it. And that was pretty cool in the day.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Not to gloss over the rest of it, but like, that's one of those like mind blow things.
Yeah.
So one thing that I wanted to get your specific input about, that in this fast paced digital era, no, we don't say stupid shit like that. but in today, where right now the economy is a little bit depressed, it is almost oversaturated with different types of, tech platforms. It blew up, right? And now we have to worry about not just how do we get our piece of the pie, but how do we like get market share that's already been taken. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about competitor displacement.
Okay.
What are some, you know, what's a soapbox or a hill that you'll die on as far as this goes?
Well, I think it's a sense of not constantly apologizing and not being afraid, right? Not being afraid to enter in and name names and compete. And when we really step back and think about that, right? And you think about like, how do you shop for a new widget, right? So what was I looking for? I was, I don't know, like a barbecue, Okay. Like, so I'm looking for a barbecue grill. I know that Weber's got the best, like they're generally the best, right? But I go out and I'm trying to say, God, do I really want to spend the $500 on this barbecue? I mean, do I really, it's just some chicken, you know, can I just get by with something for half the price? Why do I need that? So I go out and I do a search and I'm always saying, like, the brand I think I know versus some other brand, right? What is that? You grab me Google, say brand versus VS something, and you wait. Does it populate? Does it give me a clue as to like who the competitor is? And I think that if you are a brand and you're competing and you are trying to take market share and you are not speaking to the competitors that you are trying to really, really challenge, you're doing your customers complete disservice and by extension, your business, right? Because your customers want to know, right? They want to know, how does your brand compare to this other brand? Because at the end of the day, a lot of the stuff that we're selling, particularly in tech, is heavily commoditized, right? And you know, these features are kind of overlapping and they sort of look the same and it's hard to discern, like, platform this and platform that and data here and AI this and go forward and go, you know, whatever. Really need help. Like, I have, you know, competitor A versus competitor B. How do they compare? And it gives an opportunity for companies to really, you know, call it out and stipulate it and to be less afraid because it's what the customer wants. And I just see it over and over and over again where they're like, oh, well, you know, we don't want to talk bad about our competitors. This isn't that. It's helping the customer make a decision.
I agree. I see it as speaking the language of your customer, which is like the primary thing you're taught with messaging and positioning, is to put it in language that your customer would use themselves. So your customer is already saying, you know, XYZ giant brand here, you know, Fang this, Fang that, they're going to know, like, they've already been educated. It's like when Starbucks showed up and taught us all to say venti, you know, now everyone's saying venti.
Except for me, I just go, and I want the big boy.
Well, then you'll end up with the Trenta, which was, you know.
I don't even know. I want the baby. I want the big one. I never use venti. Sometimes I'll use tall. But I love that example. It's so good. And I refuse to give away more Starbucks gift cards because I don't know why, because I actually prefer Phil's. And when I'm going to San Francisco in a couple of weeks. So that's cool. Any case, there you go. Sorry. I tangentialized myself.
It's okay. That's part of what we do here. Shout out to Phil's Coffee. If you want to sponsor me, always down, please always hit me up.
Those guys.
I will not say no. They're so good. And I'm so excited that you're going to San Francisco.
Me too.
So coming back to the point, because we could easily turn this into a coffee podcast. Yeah. The point being is that, you know, there's the obvious answer of speaking the language that your customers speak and that you do have to name names. Has there been any any metrics or stories or anecdotes where you've seen this play out and you're like, wow, you know, like, we got XYZ results from doing this?
You know, that's really good, because everybody wants to keep that data private, right? So I, as a media guy, right, I'm looking at really trying to counsel, you know, them around, like, how do I go about it, right? How do I even approach this challenge that I have of saying it? And so that's more of kind of the information that I get regular access to. So you don't typically get like, holy crap, we took away, you know, X market share, or we grew X market share because we deployed this certain competitive displacement strategy. It would be more like, gee whiz, we grew. And, you know, we got really great, response rates from, you know, this particular type of an approach, right? And so that's kind of, as a media guy, that's kind of where I like to kind of get in. It's more saying, like, you know, your results are going to be your results. And so to less to name, less to name names, because I do have to sort of protect some of that, some of that stuff. But, you know, we get into, you know, particular stories around, particularly like in cybersecurity, where I was literally just coming across this the other day, where I was looking at Sentinel One, for example, and you know they had, you know, it was Sentinel One versus Palo Alto, I think, and maybe CrowdStrike. So these three were dueling, and it was so great because they all were in it, right? They were all fighting this fight within you know, organically searchable content. Right. You could go out and search any one of these guys and see kind of how they were, you know, how they were playing out. And so in terms of like what Infuse does and what kind of what we enable our clients to do and what, you know, what we see is to write that content, right? To help to create that content. And then sometimes what we'll also do is when they're really uncomfortable, they really just don't want their competitors to know that they're going after them, they'll actually host it on our domain, and then that's made intentionally sort of outbound way. we will push that content out to their target customers or the customers of their competitive their competitor target. So to your question specifically, I'm not going to answer that.
But you clock it. Once you've heard it a few times, you start to clock it and you start to notice a trend.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely exists.
It does definitely exist. And it's not really optional anymore. It's like you to say, "Oh, well, I'm a category creator." Okay, OpenAI. Okay. All right, you created a category. Yay. Good for you. Okay, how many others out here are creating categories? None anymore. Like, really, come on. And you have various versions of OpenAI right now that are creating stuff. But I mean, truly, most of the time we're sharpening, we're creating new widgets, we're creating some other set of features that satisfy a need, or we're competing on price, or we're competing on service, or some other thing. And so, if we can accept that, right, and we can accept that it's humans who are trying to figure out what to buy, because they have a problem that you're engaged in solving. All right, well, pretend that that's humans that are going to engage with your content, and then pretend like you're a consumer brand and act like them. And give them the content that you're looking for yourself when you go out and you want to, you know, pick, you know, I bought this gigantic battery on Amazon the other day. Look at this thing. It's like a 30,000 milliampere thing. And you know, I bought this because it was huge. I needed a big one because we're, you know, taking a trip and I like to go camping. So I'm like, why did I buy that one versus the others? Well, because it had these, you know, had this special plug, it had enough plugins. The other one that Amazon picked didn't. I needed that. And the company that was selling this particular one, you know, pointed that out. And that's, we get into this sort of this lofty stuff around, we're solving this problem of camping outage, right? Of camping battery, cell phone battery, deadness. Okay, great. Well, how many charges can I get on a Samsung S22? From your battery, can I plug in? How many simultaneous batteries can I charge? Can I charge at one time? Like, that's the real stuff, right? And you know, battery A can do two, battery B can do three. Oh, guess what? I'm traveling with three people. I need that. And if we extrapolate over here to B2B tech, you know, like you can cobble all that together and not really thinking about like, what does the customer really want? What do they really need? What do they really got to do here? Right. And that's an important thing. And the reason, like, for example, too, we're on StreamYard, right? StreamYard does a great job, right? They split our audio, right? That's cool. So if you're doing, you know, podcasting, right? You can, you've got, now you got two audio streams. That's awesome, right? You can live stream, you can, you know, do all kinds of fun stuff. They've really kind of nailed down some really cool, multi-factor feature sets for, you know, DIY content creators, small fry. It's great.
Yeah. And I mean, it kind of, this is why, this is the correct application of jobs to be done, is that you're, what job are you doing for the customer? If you're creating a category, are you creating a new job that the customer is doing? Probably not. You're just giving them a new solution to how to do it. And that's my bone to pick about category creation. Unless you're like, you know, magically creating a whole new thing, then I get a little bit just not quite cynical, but just a little bit like, really?
Well, I'm glad you used that word magic. And just to kind of pick on that for a second, because that is exactly, and the reason I like to use ChatGPT and OpenAI, I mean, I know that's been hammered to death, but at the same time, when that happened, when that came out, it was magic.
Yeah.
Right. And we all saw, it was this kind of stuff you'd sit around with your mom and talk about, like, holy crap, look at this. This is insane what it can do, what it has access to. Right. It's just, it is incredible what it solves and how fast and how you can actually talk to it. And that was legitimate category creation.
Yes. Right. Absolutely.
And it's that, it's like that emotional, like, oh boy, you know, this is insane what it can do. And just like when, you know, when BlackBerry comes out, right? Like that happened. And then you've got, I remember the iPod came out and you're just like, oh, wow. And then they're like, oh, well, let's take a BlackBerry and an iPod, smash them up. Great. Okay. iPhone done. And then just destroyed everybody, you know, and then everything's been a copycat after that. But still, it's like, okay, we know it when it happens, you know, airplane, you know, like, okay. <that's cool. laughs>
Can now fly in the sky.
Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah.
It is magic when it happens. There's this saying that I'm taking from someone that was inspired, was they said that they're taking science fiction to science fact. And I want to say that's a Peter Diamandis quote, but that's the magic that you need to be a category designer, is that not just like the fantastical nature of it, because before we had airplanes, we were like, oh, that's crazy, you know, but it was something that we conceived of. We just couldn't make it a fact yet. Mm. And we all conceived of AI decades ago that could talk back to us. There's entire movies like Star Trek is all about computer. What is this? You know? So it was conceived of. It was fantastical. And then when it turns into a fact is when you've actually created a category.
Yeah. Well, like 3D printing, right? When you saw 3D printing, it was like, oh, that's really going to be cool. And then it sucked. Right. Because it was like, you just this black plastic stuff. What's this? I can't eat this. I can't use it. It's not good. Anyway.
It's not a replicator.
And then even still, you know, ChatGPT generated content is still like, okay, you can kind of see it, but it's pretty good. It's hella better than the black plastic, you know, 3D printing.
Yeah. It's a baby. It's a baby. It's a toddler. When it matures, these are firm, concrete examples of things that will like displace competitors in the jobs to be done framework. Yeah. You know, the correct application of the jobs to be done framework, not the like just slap it on everything way. One thing I think about in this theme is I wonder if ChatGPT said, you know, named names and named competitors in their ads. But the thing is like, I don't think they really needed to, because they kind of went viral because it was magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, I don't know if they, I mean, maybe that is what's really true about this. Like when you truly create a new thing, you know, you can own that for a while, right? You really, you know, you really can't, like Microsoft and their, you know, their OS, right? The PC. Okay, cool. Then, you know, Mac comes out and they do their thing and it's cooler and tighter and better and, you know, way more designy, but they both still, they now they can coexist, and they, you know, they compared, you know, themselves to each other for a long, long time and still sort of do, but they don't really even need to anymore. The markets are just so big.
I wonder if that's like our disclaimer, because there's always some part of it where someone like misses the point entirely, or they're just off center, or they don't quite understand the soapbox that we're suggesting today of naming your competitor, is that sometimes your competitor is the job to be done and not necessarily a business organization. Either way, you have to be brave enough to give it a name that your customer is familiar with.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been coming up a lot lately. Like your competitor, a lot of times your biggest competitor is do nothing, right? Or excel. I'm reading the book, Obviously Awesome, by April Dunford, right? And it's a positioning book. And it's like, that's your competitor, right? Excel. Do the thing in Excel, right? You know, record a video and, you know, and email it to each other. That's your competitor, right? You know, to StreamYard. So, like, okay, let's name that. Here's why you would use Excel, right? And why you would use free. Here's the cases, and here's why you shouldn't use free, right? Here's why you need this fancy CRM platform, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. In my newsfeed recently was how Google is releasing a new like video from still picture thing, and they're calling it Vlogger, right? Okay. We all know what a vlogger is. We already use that phrase. It's a video blogger. Mm-hmm. And so that would be another like concrete example of naming what they're trying to displace. They're trying to displace people recording video blogs or video content and, you know, just using a still picture. What other times, I guess, would it be appropriate for someone to like not name their competitor? Is there ever a time?
There may have been. Well, okay. So this old sales stuff is like, it's bad form to bash your competitor, right? Like that's genuinely and generally accepted as a standard operating procedure. Like, you never want to talk bad about your competitor, right? Coke, Pepsi, right? Like, never say like, oh, well, that stuff rots your teeth. Well, they both do. Okay. You know, so get over it, right? That's expensive. Oh, well, guess what? They're both expensive. So I think if we can separate from competitor bashing, right? And just really accept that it's, as long as we're not doing that, then we need to name names. We need to dedicate a portion of the marketing effort to helping the customer discern, you know, what it was. And the risk, I think the risk is like, well, the customer didn't know that you had that competitor. Okay, well, you can mitigate or protect against that risk by, you know, not putting it front and center. Don't put it on your homepage, right? Okay. You can bury it. Don't have to link to it. You don't have to make a big deal about it, but you can certainly make it indexable so that if somebody is searching, they're going to find it, right? You can participate in and support and otherwise work to compete in, you know, in particularly in tech, you know, where let's say you're a bank, right? It's not like I don't know where what the banks are in town.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why would you want to choose bank A over bank B? Well, because I don't know. Why would you, right? I mean, how do you even do that? Like at some level, there's got to be a willingness to say like, well, choose U.S. Bank over Bank of America because, you know, we got the coolest promotion. We got the best toasters in town. I don't know, whatever they got, right? So in tech, where I tend to, you know, like to play, I think you could, you know, have executives and VCs and whoever else is worried, legal maybe, they can chill out a little bit by just saying, look, we're gonna kind of, maybe we're going to gate this, or we're going to put it behind a, you know, we're going to not make it easily findable, you know, by just the general public. But you know, you could certainly find it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer to satisfying legal and compliance would be to use objective data, objective known facts, not mm-hmm. subjective, right? If you can say so-and-so has this, you know, feature and we have this one, that's the right way to do it. Because it's back to your, does this have three plugs for my USB, for my charger? That's mm-hmm. that's your driver for choosing between the two. Mm-hmm. And having that sort of, you know, checkbox for what we offer versus what they offer, I always love those type of battle cards, is objective. It's not calling names, and it's factual. So you can't really get like a cease and desist. Unless, like, you know, you take it too far or you make up stuff. But,
yeah,
true. You know, if you date it, like, as, you know, facts known to be, I love actual disclaimer. I don't love actual disclaimers. I just understand how to use them. Okay. And it would be like, you know, as of this date, based on our research, you know, and then, you know, give legal some screenshots where you found that information.
Right.
But if it's already out there, like it's already out there, your customer's going to find it either before or after they sign with you. And I'm of the thought that it builds trust to be transparent mm-hmm. in a reasonable sense where they're going to find it after they sign up for you. And what's going to make them double down on their choice for you, knowing why they're choosing you or just choosing you because you were, you know, first, that they may not renew.
Yeah.
Like that's they might just jump ship. They'd be like, oh, well, you know, I didn't vet both of you. I just signed up with you because that was the first one I saw. And now I'm unhappy because I really wanted this one feature. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, sure. You got their short term win. But now you've messed around with your other metrics of, you know, retention because they're going to jump. And, you know, were they like how it's that delicate balance between long term and short term.
Yeah, I'm preaching to the choir on all of this stuff, right? Like we have got to really invest in transparency and really like fair dealing and making sure that our customers know exactly what they're getting, right? So like I got a renewal notice from whoever StreamYard's competitor was. I was with them for a long time. I've totally put it out of my mind. I just totally forgot about it. So much I can't remember their name anymore, but they renewed me right without like any kind of prompt. Like it was just like bump, renew. What? And I'm like, okay, you didn't tell me nothing. And then I went back to try to get my money back, and they gave me a really hard time about it. And then finally I complained so much and I did a chargeback on the credit card. They relented. But it was painful and it was anxiety producing, right? Versus I had an experience with Norton who did the same thing. Right. Who said, hey, you're renewed for $381. And isn't this great? And I'm like, you're kind of invasive. You use a lot of resources. You know, it's not my favorite solution, but I'm thinking about it. Cause they said, look, you've got 60 days to change your mind. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Right. I don't need to freak out. I don't need to go into some sort of convulsive reactive position, you know? And I think, if we come up to these kinds of opportunities where we're making that initial purchase, you could say, well, this security platform has a renewal policy that is stated right here. There you go. That's what that looks like. Here's ours. Here's what that looks like. Take a pick.
Yeah.
Do that. And I bet that there's, or, you know, you're going to get some looks.
I mean, either way, what we know about human behavior is that people are going to forget anyways. They don't care about you as much as you think they do as a brand. Mm-hmm. Like, people need it. Think about how many – I'm going to start back at the beginning. In the sales process, it takes repeated touches, like multiple touches to close a sale. You know, upwards from 10, as many as – who knows? Like it's a black box of many, many, many touches. If you think that you are going to have some bit of information, you're going to tell someone once and they're going to hold on to it for dear life, and that's going to be everybody remembers that, you're mistaken. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, at Disneyland, there wouldn't be people in the outfits telling people where to go. There wouldn't be maps. There wouldn't be sign. There wouldn't be an app. There wouldn't be like 10 different signs with 10 different arrows. Like, you have to repeatedly tell people. And so the risk associated with just telling people once is so minimal. Mm. And it should, there's no reason not to do it. Like, it's just made up barriers and obstacles. That's my little soapbox for,
nice.
For that. It's like, you have to spell it out in crayons because we're busy.
Yeah. 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 It, you do. It's funny. It brings up this, there's a move afoot in the outbound sales prospecting world that we have to write these super short, to the point emails, like the shorter, the better. I'm like, okay. I've tried everything. Okay. Believe me. I've tried aggressive language. I've tried passive language. I've tried what you name it. And I hate this idea of super short email messages. I just can't stand it because you can really only maximally email somebody, particularly a cold prospect, once a day. Like, that's the most you could ever even begin to do. What are you trying to say? Like, okay, I have to ask for the meeting. I have to give them a reason. I have to have a valuable, proposition. I have to know them. I have to, like, it has to be personalized somehow. All in 50 words or less, once a day at most. And probably maybe twice a week is probably realistically the most. And if you get that wrong, then you alienate everybody. I'm like, you know what? Screw that. I'm just going to tell the story I need to tell. And if it's long, so be it. I can't get on this 50 word email bus. I just cannot do it. And if you can't deal with my long email, well then, okay, I guess we weren't going to do business anyway, because I wasn't going to write you the 50. Anyway, I don't even know how I got started on that. Sorry, I just kind of go off.
Just the repeated touches, right? Because there's in sales and outbound sales, there is a certain cadence, a certain frequency, a certain amount of, space in a single email to mess with. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the fastest, most efficient way to bring it back to our theme of writing that email is to name names. Are you a customer of blah, blah, blah? We do that too, but we also have these three features. We've researched you and that seems like it might be up your alley. That fits. That makes sense. That's speaking their language. It's well positioned. And I'd much rather, as a, target, please don't start blowing up my inbox. But I would much rather, as a target, get a meaningful email. If you are writing me a novel, I'm not going to read it. I'm sorry. Like, if it's too long, there is too long. But if you write me kind of a snarky, mean, like, oh, are we breaking up? Like, kind of email. I would much rather you just swap that out for the, hey, you use blah, blah, blah. We do blah, blah, blah. The competitor displacement email. I would prefer that. Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know. I appreciate that. That's good. That is good input that I'll actually probably put to use. I did have a good experience, and I've had a good experience this week actually, because I'm running my own show, this countdown to RSAC, and I'm going to RSA to meet my assigned accounts, right? People, marketers at my assigned accounts, and I'm doing this show as a build up, right? I'm like, hey, I need guests for my little show, right? It's not a big show. It doesn't have any budget, right? It's just me creating content in anticipation of this big event. And so I've been emailing out like, hey, do you want to be a guest? Do you on the show? Do you want to go to the Cybersecurity Marketing Society party? Do you want to meet up maybe or not, or just tune into the show? And I'm actually getting like replies, believe it or not. And I've actually gotten three guests to appear between now and May 3rd. So I'm like, holy cow, that's fun, right? So there's a little something. And it was naming names and it was being specific and it was finding something that we could come together on that wasn't just me saying, hey, you want a demo of my, my offer.
Yeah. It fit your ideal person. And yeah. And it's a good show, by the way. I would suggest that people listen to it, watch it, show up, watch the reruns. I can't go, but it made me excited about it. And I'm like, oh, I'm really missing out now. Like, so the FOMO is strong.
Nice.
So I think that, you know, that's one way that you can interweave things in, I hate calling it ABM, but like you do want to name things that are specific to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think that there's so many ways to go about it. There's so many ways, but at the end of the day, you just got to go with what works.
I keep looking. If something isn't working, move on from it and keep looking for more ideas of things that might work. Right. I was kind of down in the weeds of that as I was thinking about, you know, like I don't like to make cold dials. Just don't. Right. I don't enjoy that. I can, and I have, but they just don't ever go very well. And you think about this because the customers don't want that. Nobody wants a cold dial. They don't want to receive it. I mean, yeah, you can finesse your way and smooth talk and do all that, but it's a drag. And even cold email is kind of a drag. And so for me, it was like, okay, if I can do those things and I can get, you know, infinitesimally low response rates, do I really want to keep doing them, particularly if everybody else is, that's what they're doing? Or do I want to continue to try to innovate into some other approach that could be better, right? Could actually work reliably and be fun and be unique in market. And so that's really what drives me now. It's like trying to figure that stuff out and committing to, you know, certain things. And I've tried lots of stuff and a lot of stuff doesn't work, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. She's like, well, okay. And you have to give it a time. You have to, you know, really invest. And you know, fortunately, I've you know, kind of far enough along, enough salty old dog here that I can survive. But it's you're taking some risks and trying some new things.
Yeah, definitely. I think you just told my origin story of how I ended up moving from sales to marketing.
Oh, really?
pretty much. And the too long don't read or didn't read. But so innovation is such a fun word. It makes me wonder about like what the future is. Like where do you think the future of marketing is? And do you think that's the same as where it should go?
It's a question that's been on my mind recently because as a seller, right? Which is, you know, kind of where I sit. But I sell to marketers, and so and I sell generally marketing solutions. So I'm sort of in this hybrid world. I'm exposed to marketing a lot. I think what's emerging is a chasm, like between the selling motion and what sales really should be doing, right? And what sales is really good at, and that's engaging one-on-one with customers who are interested in your product. Right, who want more information about it, and they need to be doing a lot of that, a lot more of that, right? And marketing, doing things to you know position the company, make sure that the product is in the right you know segment or is positioned you know well for you know optimal pricing and uptake and so on. That the customer's demands are being you know. You know, met and heard, and that the brand is being, you know, developed and there's awareness of it and positive, you know, receptivity to it and so on. And so you have this big chasm where marketing gets stuck trying to feed the sales machine, right? Because it's, you know, trying to, you know, sales hungry, right? So sales is oversized a lot of times. So there's too much capacity on the sales team and they get stuck trying to, you know, spin their own wheels. So I really think that marketing, the opportunity for marketing take sales out of the marketing business, if you will. And if you're going to keep sales in the marketing business, to help them act more like marketers and less like sellers, if you will, right? And if we say like, okay, this like a cold dial and a cold email and all that, it's still kind of a marketing function technically, but the end customer sees it as a sales thing, right? And it's a sales slash marketing thing that's just ugly and gross and nobody likes. So how about we stop doing that? And how about we give sales better tools to and better tactics to, you know, show up and make customers happier? And as marketers, I think that there's an opportunity to align better with this big old team who's hungry and willing, and or had better be willing to do more, I guess, prospecting-ish stuff that looks and feels more like marketing. God, that was vague and fluffy. I mean, I don't know if I'm making any sense. It's still hard to articulate.
Here's where I think you've hit the nail on the head about the sibling rivalry between sales and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the biggest things that like get under my skin is when I've made a beautiful deck that is meant to like psychologically follow somebody from A to B. And it is a marketing deck, but it's also like sales enablement. And it's supposed to do certain things with mm-hmm. certain methodologies. And the salesperson has then made it into a sales thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns into like super aggressive. The whole page is full. There's no more white space. And it just turns into this no longer marketing, not effective at sales, like Frankenstein deck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the rivalry comes, is that it's whose is it, who gets like, you know, final say. And this has to be established beforehand in the expectations of the company culture. Mm-hmm. And knowing the strengths and weaknesses, because there are some people that are very good at taking something and customizing it just for them as the seller. And there's other people that maybe aren't aware of what they're, you know, they don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know how this thing has now morphed into ineffective.
Mm.
And so from a marketing perspective, I've seen that happen. And so the line in the sand of what is marketing and what is sales is so difficult, because you guys have such firsthand knowledge that is so powerful.
Yeah.
That maybe it should be left to you for the outreach emails. Oh, I think it should, to some extent.
To some extent, you know, it's really tricky stuff, because you know, you have competencies that you have to deal with on an individual seller to seller to seller, company to company basis, right? Some people can do it or have capacity for it, and others don't, right? Like they can't, and or they just don't know, or they're not, you know, tuned to it. But I think maybe just drawing a line and saying like, here's where sales starts and here's where marketing, you know, and where it ends, right? And what I'm hearing in the market right now, in terms of like my take on the data, is that customers would prefer it if sales is more salesy. And by that I mean, like, look, when I'm ready and willing and able to evaluate your product, I will tell you, and I will engage with your company at that time. Stop bugging me in advance, right? Stop doing that. And it's okay for marketing to do that, right? And so marketing has to say, okay, well, guess what? Our sales team is no longer going to be doing outbound prospecting. Done. Oh, well, now we have a whole bunch more capacity. What are we going to do with all these sellers trying to do? Well, guess what? We better ramp up our marketing efforts so that those guys are full, or maybe we need to reduce the size of our team and deal with that reality, which is not going to make anybody happy. But at the same time, it's real. And how does marketing then position itself to say, all right, if sales isn't going to be doing any outbound, what do we have to do in order to keep the lights on, so that when sales is actually working and talking, they're selling, they're not marketing.
Yeah.
And that is I think it's a good question, because this democratization of data that has continued to not go away. And you know, we've been talking about like competitor displacement, like it's on marketing, I think, to write content that speaks to how does, you know, your solution compared to, you know, any number of other solutions, you have to do that. That falls on marketing. Sales can kind of make it up on a one-to-one basis deep into the sales process. But should they be, are they the ones responsible for creating that content, you know, from the beginning, so that when the unknown customer is searching and trying to figure out what's what and who's who and how these play together? I don't think so, right? And I think we can agree on that, you know, that's a marketing driven, in product marketing particularly probably would be invested in that kind of making that kind of content available.
Yeah.
So,
It's upstream. It's upstream. I think that sales and marketing definitely agree on what you're saying. I think it's that leadership views last touch attribution to who closed the deal. They don't see marketing as an investment to get dollars in the door. They see sales as that investment because sales is the person that converted that person or that account into the sale. And so in the economic squeeze, when we hear about efficiency and, you know, I think that there has to be very attuned leadership to understand that cost per click is going up. You know, like all of these marketing motions are just going to get more and more expensive because they are. They just are. Like it's the cost of doing business. And so while you were talking, I was thinking about like sales led marketing versus, you know, different types of things. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at this is like, you know, deciding for each organization where you're realistically drawing that line in the sand. And are you letting sellers sell and marketers market? And have you invested accordingly?
Yeah. And well, and two, if you're going to make your sellers market, right, if you're going to make them do outbound prospecting, teach them, help them do teach better. Them. Like how, and if anything, not to toot my own horn, but by golly, that's what I'm trying to do. Like constantly, like saying, oh, guess what? Tactic A doesn't really work for me. Maybe it works for somebody else enough, well enough, and they're willing to do it. But for me, I couldn't make it work. And so I need to invent some other thing that seems to be more resonant with my customers. Right. And I'm doing it myself. You know, that's just the culture of, you know, that I'm in right now, which is fine. And I have the autonomy and sort of authority to do that, which is great, but not all organizations do. And if they're going to make their sellers prospect and create new business, then they need to be really aware of what the customers want and the experience that they want to have, what's working. And if it isn't working, do something different. Don't just throw more bodies at it. You know, cause I do think that execs are saying, well, golly, for $1 million, I can get, you know, whatever, 50,000 leads or something from, you know, contents in or clicks or inbound or, you know, X number of pieces of content, whatever. And, or impressions or something. Well, I could hire 10 SDRs for that. And those 10 SDRs could, you know, make 100 calls a day, blah, 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 volume it up. And I'd have these bodies and I'd have trained people and they might be looking at that saying, well, you know, it's a better investment. And I don't know that it is. That's a thing.
It's not, because what happens was the first thing that someone does is they go Google it, they go search it, and then they go to your website. And if your website is a wasteland or is just like book a demo, they're like, look, what is the information I came to search? They want the self-serve. They want the content. They want the credibility of seeing that this isn't like a fake business. Because we worry about those now. We worry about the history of the business, the longevity of it. Is this going to go bankrupt or disappear? You know, they want to know that what they're signing up for. And the way that you do that is your online digital and physical presence.
Yeah.
So I think there's
LinkedIn too. Like, are your people on LinkedIn? Are they doing anything? You know, are they good?
And do they have a profile picture?
Yeah. Like, and can, you know, do they engage? Have they ever posted any, do they make comments? Do they participate in community? And I think you and I are probably both sort of extreme ends of that spectrum, but the, that bar is not very high, right? To show that people are actually, you know, that you have a pulse.
Yeah. All right. Well, I feel like there's so much for us to unpack and talk forever, but I'm going to ask you the last question, which is behind the curtain. What is a question someone should ask you, but they don't? People take this as, hey, you know, I really love talking about this part of my, you know, personal life. I have this passion about this thing. And then other people take it as, you know, everyone comes to me for X, Y, and Z, but they're missing the point. They really need to start over here at ABC. What is a question someone should ask you that they don't?
Well, on a personal, let's just, we've talked a lot about business already. And you know, yeah, we can talk about that till the end of time, but I'm gonna talk about kids for a second. What people don't ask me about, and something that I believe in with all my heart and soul, is that you do not get quality time with your kids unless you give them quantity time. And that the highest quality time comes from the little mundane moments, right? The moments in those mundane activities, right? The opportunity to, you know, help them, you know, learn a new skill or to learn about, and as they get older, these things get a little more complicated, but that quantity time cannot be, like, you can't give them too much of it. And I wish people were willing to kind of talk about that and understand how important that is, and, you know, would ask me about that. But I don't get very many questions about, like, what's it actually like to raise four kids and, you know, be on the other side of that. And really, because mine are older now, and I'm still raising them, but they're, you know, they're more independent than they were.
Yeah, I have such as a mom. What I learned very early on was that you're always wrong. You're always wrong.
Yeah.
And instead of worrying so much about advice, is to follow your heart and really find the connection in the mundane things, and just what a treasure children are. Mm-hmm. And I'm always down to talk about kids, and sometimes it interferes with how people perceive me as a professional. But I gotta say, it changes so much about your life. And I think that it's not – I fully support people who don't want to have kids. I support them because it is – something that you need to wake up every morning and be excited and choose to do, and choose to do it well. Mm-hmm. And as someone who values that, and that's part of, like, my ethos as a person and just my identity, whether or not it should be, it's not for everybody, but the people who are for it, like, it's great. And I support everybody's choices. But the mundane things, the waking up, the early morning snuggles or the breakfast routines or the carpools, I think finding joy in anyone's life over the small moments is pivotal to our overall happiness.
There you go. And I would love to talk about that some more. And I'm just not getting enough of it, particularly in these sort of professional frameworks. But, you know, I feel like I've got a lot to offer just because I've been parenting now for 24 and a half years. So I, I've seen some stuff. I have seen real stuff that would, you know, make your blood turn cold, and it's, you know, really, really scary stuff and really amazing, wonderful stuff. And, you know, that's something I wish people would ask me more about.
Yeah. Well, if people do want to follow up on that conversation and share their stories with you, professional and personal, what is the best way for them to do that?
You know, LinkedIn right now. I mean, I know it's so sort of cliche to say that. It's really the best place to reach me, you know, reliably. I know the DM system is total crap, but I don't really love text. SMS is tough. I mean, I am on Facebook Messenger. You could look me up there and, you know, send me that. But LinkedIn is so much richer because that's where I hang out, right? That's just kind of where I am. And you can kind of see what's on my mind, what we're talking about, who I'm hanging out with, what I'm, you know, where I spend the bulk of my sort of professional life. And, you know, I do keep my, my personal sort of stuff, a little bit more cordoned off, but you know, if we have a friendship and a relationship, then, you know, we can go down and get into those roads. But, you know, like, so our first outreach, or like, let's just kind of get to know each other. I'm there, I'm hanging out. And chances are, if it's a real non pitch slap kind of thing, I'll reply. Yeah. It's good.
Yeah. Awesome. And could you spell your name for people so that if they're listening only, they know which Trevor you are?
Trevor Van Worden, VanWoerden, and I'm at IN/TrevorJVW on LinkedIn. So yeah, you can find me that way.
Awesome. This is Leanne, and if you want to get a hold of me, I'm also chronically online on LinkedIn, and you can also email me info@markigy.com. Thank you for listening. Remember to always give feedback and to just be a kind human. Have a good day.
Thanks, Leanne.
Thanks.